Hello and welcome back to Marca's Eye on La Liga, the official podcast of Spain's biggest newspaper in the English language. And, well, we've taken a week off. I'm Mark Mayer, your host for this week's show. We basically took a week off because nothing was happening, and now there is plenty to discuss in the world of Spanish football after an incredible weekend, really, when Real Madrid came back from the death to beat Malaga 3-2 at home at the Estadio Santiago Bernabeu, and down in Valencia, the top of the table clash. Valencia 1, Barcelona 1, but that scoreline does not tell anything like the whole story. I'm joined this week by Ewan McTeer. It's great to have you back on the show, Ewan, mate. How's it going?
Yeah, good, good. It's a perfect week to come back and start talking again. And yeah, like you say, so much happened this week. It started off with a rainy, drab draw with a 1-0 win even for Celta Vigo over Leganés. But after that, the goals were flying, and goals in every game. And plenty of them, so yeah, lots to get torn into.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll have to start at the Estadio Mestalla then. As I just mentioned, it was a 1-1 draw between Valencia and Barcelona on Sunday night. Valencia taking the lead in this one, Rodrigo Moreno getting another goal as Simone Zaza made a return to the starting lineup as well. And then Lionel Messi with the magic, as he always provides pretty much on every big occasion, setting up Jordi Alba, becoming quite a bit of a partnership, Messi and Jordi Alba. It wasn't the sort of thing that you really saw coming, that these two players would be so integral to the Valverde system. And Barcelona have been more industrially set up than we're sort of used to. Is this sort of a combination that you sort of expected to come up, or were you expecting maybe Messi and Suarez to be the two key players for Valverde as he's taken charge now?
Yeah, I think I was surprised as you are. I mean, you know, Messi normally is drifting on the right side of the attack and Jordi Alba is a left back, so they're just about as far away as they could possibly be from each other on the tactics board. But yeah, they have this magnificent combination that helps when Messi can, you know, with a little flick of his left boot, provide that sort of arching diagonal ball that sort of just drops over a defender's head and it's so hard to kind of judge where it's going to land, but Jordi Alba always knows it's going to land just about where he's running to. And yeah, they have this, like you say, this brilliant partnership, and I'm not sure if it's one that even Valverde maybe expected. It's probably a bit of a pleasant surprise, but at the same time, I mean, these two players have been playing together for years now, and when you look at the great Barcelona teams of old, I mean, of the players Messi used to link up with, not many of them are left, so I guess he's got to turn to the tried and tested Jordi Alba left-back group.
Yeah, it does certainly feel as if they have that the Guardiola-esque sort of knowledge of how Barcelona are used to playing and everything. And yet, as we found that Valverde's been a lot more defensive in his setup, I kind of found that in this game, Valencia outran and they out-battled Barcelona. They won a lot more of the 50-50s. Do you think that that's a fair reflection on the game? Would you say that Valencia may be the better team, or was it actually pretty even in your mind?
I think Valencia were definitely the better team, like as you say, in terms of maybe running more and busting the gut a bit more. But at the same time, maybe Barcelona weren't trying to match Valencia for that, because they've probably seen how much energy, how much pace this Valencia side have. They also didn't have to play against Juventus in midweek, of course. So this is maybe it would have been foolish if Barcelona did try to match Valencia in that sort of category. I think Valencia were certainly the better team in the second half. The first half was a bit more even. Barcelona didn't always have the ball in the areas that they're most effective, but they did sort of seem to be in control, and Marc-Andre ter Stegen, he wasn't called upon too much in the first half. But yeah, in the second half, when Valencia scored their goal, it was you kind of felt it was coming. I don't know about you, but when it went in, you're always looking at the clock and thinking, has it taken Valencia this long?
Yeah, definitely. It was a this is the first half. We'll have to go on to now, because the best chance that Valencia had before they did score was Simone Zaza, I thought, shooting wide from just outside the box, which came seconds after the big elephant in the room for the first 4 minutes or so of this podcast. And that was it a ghost goal? Do we call it a phantom goal, a disallowed goal? I'm not really sure.
I don't know. I think the ghost goals is that when they go in and when they're given as a goal, but it wasn't. So is this like a, I don't know, like a, yeah, let's call it a phantom goal. I like that. It's a bit more unique.
Yeah, we need to get in on our football cliches to bring this up. But I definitely think that it is one of those moments where, you know, with the ball, it was in midair, so I can sort of understand why the linesman doesn't see it. But that is ultimately why you have goal line technology. It's why every other European league, every major international tournament has goal line technology. Do you think that this is just another incidence of La Liga perhaps being embarrassed, or is this some sort of tipping point in this regard for you?
Yeah, I think embarrassment is the word to use. I mean, this was obviously top of the table clash. This was, you know, you probably had fans tuning in from all around the world. Maybe don't watch La Liga every week. Maybe probably weren't watching that pretty poor game on Friday night, Celta Vigo Leganés, but they would have turned in for this one because it was, you know, Barcelona against a very impressive Valencia side that they might have wanted to check out. And yeah, a lot of people were probably wondering, well, where is the technology for this? I mean, it's used in the Champions League. It's used in Spanish stadiums in the Champions League, so there's no reason why it can't be implemented. It just seems La Liga is a little bit too behind, and you know, it's going to come. It's coming next season, but not any earlier than that. And it's yeah, just maybe another example of La Liga being a little bit behind in terms of organisation and logistics behind the other major European leagues, and of course the Champions League.
It's an interesting case that they haven't. We've reported on Marca on Monday morning that effectively they're not going to decide to bring it forward any earlier. La Liga aren't going to come and, you know, just say from tomorrow, whatever stadiums have it, and we'll act to get everything forward as quickly as they can. They're not doing that, which I think is a bit strange. And also reporting on Monday on Marca that the VAR trial that's happening in Copa del Rey will not be at the Atletico Madrid Elche game in midweek. So this idea that, you know, if La Liga are going to be claiming that they're at the forefront of football, I do think that it's just a very simple case of organisation, perhaps a little bit more investment. And I mean, ultimately, it's very hard to argue with those things at the end of the day. One thing I do want to ask you about then, before we move away from the phantom slash ghost slash Casper goal, whatever we kind of call it, is the Valverde comments I thought were really interesting, because we had Luis Enrique, whenever he was in the press conference room, it was like he didn't really want to be there. You know, he came out with all sort of snide comments. But Valverde's, it shows his different track as Barcelona coach, doesn't it? When his main comment on this was, well, you know, Barcelona had a lucky goal against Malaga that was kind of crossed the byline and should maybe have counted. But isn't that interesting that that's what he goes to? Why do you think that he went for those comments? Do you think he just wants to, you know, simmer down this debate, or is that just who he is as a person?
Yeah, I think it is who he is as a person. I mean, everybody's said for years of what a genuine and honest coach he is. And, you know, maybe it's a case of he knows that the reaction, he knows that people will be talking about how refreshing his comments were. So maybe he knows that, you know, if he goes down the route of claiming that Barcelona were hard done by, claiming that it's a big conspiracy, he knows most people aren't going to sympathise with him over that. So the fact that he can come out and point, you know, you win some, you lose some. I mean, everybody, I think, that watched that interview came away with a bit more respect for him if he didn't have that amount of respect for him already. And the most interesting thing that I guess we can take away from that interview is, you know, this isn't just a unique case of a ghost phantom Casper goal. This is, it happened, like Valverde just said, it happened a few weeks ago in that game against Malaga, albeit across the byline, not across the goal line. Happened in the first week of the season as well. I think Getafe it was, were done out of a goal away at Athletic. So it's not the first time, and maybe that's partly what Valverde's seen as well. I mean, he wasn't Barcelona coach then, but there was another one last season, of course, Barcelona away at Real Betis. So maybe he's just trying to emphasise the point of, right, come on, this is time to really sort this out. It's not the first time. We've even been hard done by it. So I don't know. What did you make of his comments? I thought they were refreshing, but yeah, maybe there was a hidden objective to what he said.
Yeah, I definitely think he's just there to sort of keep a lid on things, and maybe he doesn't want Barcelona to be part of the controversies. Maybe he tries to go under the radar as Barcelona coach, which is an incredibly difficult act to undertake. Let's finish this discussion on the Valencia-Barcelona game, talking about Los Che. The interesting thing to come out of this was how, you know, I think we can all sort of agree that Valencia are looking like the real deal of some sort. They're definitely going to be there. I thought that the talk about Rodrigo being booked for the wearing of the wig. I mean, you can shed us some light on exactly why he did that a little bit more, but the idea that he'd have been booked for it and then subsequently sent off later in the game, perhaps, I just thought that was a load of nonsense myself.
Yeah, I think, I mean, going by the rule book, you know, these kind of celebrations that take too long, that get involved with the crowd, you know, most of them, by the rule book, there should be a booking. I don't think there should be, but if you're going by the rule book, maybe he should have been given a yellow card. The referee seemed to have it in his hand, but at the same time, you have to look at why he did that. And that was, it wasn't just a random celebration, even though I do like a bit of Scottish ginger here in La Liga. If we could have that after every goal, that would be great. But it was a tribute to the late Jaime Ortiz, former Valencia president, and you know, back in the day when Valencia were maybe as maybe the last time Valencia were this good, when they were winning leagues. And he wore an orange wig after a game away at Real Zaragoza, given to him by fans. So this was pre-planned, and Rodrigo even said, you know, he went and bought it himself after the funeral. So yeah, a really, really nice gesture, and it would have been a shame if he was booked for it, even if going by the rule book, maybe that should have been the case. Fortunately, it wasn't too big a controversy, and yeah, it wasn't like Rodrigo went on to score another goal or anything like that. So I guess we can just kind of put that one in the history books and move on from it.
Yeah, let it be. The question then has to be, if Valencia are going to be title contenders, what might be their undoing? I get a sense that it's a little too early to say, I mean, X or Y will definitely be an issue, but do you sense that there's maybe something in January they can go and improve, or is there a tactical sort of, is there something that is glaringly obvious for Valencia to sort out, or is it just a sort of nebulous case of maybe their inexperience will show, or maybe Marcelino will make an error later in the season? Is there anything you can see that's glaring that they need to fix in the coming weeks?
I don't think there's that many obvious weaknesses, but the one thing is the fact that Simone Zaza's knee seems to be sort of hanging by a couple of threads, and you know, obviously he was able to deal with this sort of lingering injury to play this game, but he finished the game sort of clutching his knee, and you have to wonder if how long that knee is going to hold out. And if he goes down, then, you know, Rodrigo's been playing well, Santi Mina's done well when he's come on, but he's undoubtedly been their main goal scoring threat. So if he was to go down, then maybe that could be the thing that scuppers this this title bid.
That's certainly something to look out for in the next couple of weeks, then, with Simone Zaza briefly being brought back into the Italy fold as well. So it'll be interesting to see how his fitness stacks up then. As we move on, let's head back to the centre of the country, and where Real Madrid faced Malaga at the start of the weekend to sort of kick everything off. 3-2 at finish, but I wanted to talk about the start of the game when Real Madrid fans held their sort of pre-game protest of holding red cards up. Was this just a case of typical, you know, Madrid versus Barcelona, who's getting the meat of the decisions going against them? Obviously, in hindsight, we know that the Barcelona fans have plenty to complain about this weekend. But is there actually going to be a route out of this sort of anti-refereeing sentiment that you get in both Clasico teams? Or is it just going to be a fact of life now?
Well, I think, yeah, it's you know, it's looking for excuses. I think, you know, Real Madrid haven't been playing too well at all. I mean, we had another article in Marca from Jose Felix Diaz talking about Real Madrid aren't failing because of the refereeing. It's their football that's to blame, and maybe some fans don't want to blame the football. They want to find someone else to vent their anger towards, and that's understandable. There have been some decisions have gone against Real Madrid, but it wasn't a particularly great day to stage this protest, given that you know, went on, Malaga had a goal ruled out, which, you know, for a very, very, very slight shove on Dani Carvajal, most referees would probably let that stand. So maybe it wasn't the best day or the best weekend, of course, with that goal that was disallowed for Barcelona in at the Mestalla. So yeah, maybe that was a little bit of the refereeing gods, if there is such a thing, just getting their own back on the Real Madrid fans for protesting that one, because you know, the red cards before the game, but they looked a bit red faced at the end of it, because the Malaga players and the owner and the coach all had plenty to say afterwards about how they were the ones who were done out of the points for that weekend.
Yeah, well, it turned out to be a penalty that did secure Real Madrid the points in the end. I don't think there's any reason to disagree with it being a penalty.
But no.
The Cristiano Ronaldo taunt is always Penaldo, isn't it? That he only scores penalties, and he's found an excellent way of getting around that now by missing the penalty and subsequently scoring the rebound. I mean, we had a good article by Jose Felix Diaz from the Marca over the weekend saying that it's not the referees that have been getting in the way of Real Madrid. It's been the performances. I'll just read a little snippet of it here if anyone wants to go and review that. It's on the Real Madrid section of the Marca English website. Jose's basically saying that Madrid don't fail because of the referees, it's their football to blame. The defensive system isn't working, and it didn't help that Kiko Casilla was weak against Malaga. And the midfielder far too confident and blasé and just lose the ball too many times. I think it's 8 times against Malaga the ball was turned over. Is that something you agree with? Did you say that basically, I think the confident and blasé note is really poignant there, because the midfield three of Cruz, Modric, Casemiro and the backup they have, I mean, they should be absolutely dominating every game. And it's just not been happening this season, has it?
Yeah, I think you have to agree with everything said there. And yeah, I mean, even Toni Kroos was giving the ball away, led to a goal. I mean, when Kroos gives the ball away, I think that's obviously a sign that the apocalypse is near or something like that. So, you think Kroos is one of the best passers of the ball in the game. There's no reason for him to be so lackadaisical, and it might just be a sort of, not necessarily attitude, but just a maybe overconfidence, maybe a just like the word blasé is, I think, sums it up a little bit, that midfield. It's as much as Modric, Kroos and Casemiro are three of the best midfielders in the world, it was quite interesting that, yeah, Lucas Vazquez, he was probably one of the better performers for Real Madrid. What did you make of him coming on for a very rare appearance this season? I thought he played really well, and it was good to see Real Madrid with a bit of wood for once.
Yeah, Lucas Vazquez is the only, I think, unless you're going to play Ronaldo as a left winger, and obviously Bale being fit or unfit, I think Vazquez is the only genuine wing, like a winger, wide midfielder option in that squad, because everyone else, Isco, obviously Modric, Cruz, Ceballos, Kovacic, they are all very central and they do like to get on the ball and look up, whereas Vazquez is that old-fashioned sort of driving, gets into good positions, puts the ball into the box winger. And when there's no Bale, I think he's the only player that can really provide that for them.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And it's we've seen so many great wingers at Real Madrid over the years, and for them to only really have one or a couple who really play in that position is quite unusual, I reckon.
Yeah, I'll just run down the Marca English player ratings votes that we have on the website after every Madrid-Barcelona game. The fans gave Modric, Ronaldo and Casemiro the top performing votes. I think Casemiro is another one who, generally speaking, did have a good role in that game, certainly off the ball. Down at the bottom end, though, Marcelo continued to lose his faith, or the faith of the fans in him, continues to drop down, as he was one of the lowest marked players, as was Kiko Casilla, who it appears now are Keylor Navas coming back into the team for the Copa del Rey. Kiko Casilla's sort of position in the team and long-term future in the team really is under threat. And I know you've been looking at the Kepa Arrizabalaga transfer rumours with Daniela on the website, and wondering, is this a move that's going to be happening in January or in the summer or not at all?
Yeah, one of the points we made in that video was, at this stage, Kepa, I mean, he's only got 35 La Liga matches under his belt, so he's probably not going to dethrone Keylor Navas at this stage. But the point we're making is he's obviously an option for the future, and he'd be a much better understudy, I think, than Kiko Casilla at the moment. So, if Real Madrid can secure that deal in January or next summer, then I think it'd be a very worthwhile addition, because you've got your man for down the line, and you've also got someone who's going to be an excellent replacement for Keylor Navas if he continues to have injury issues.
Certainly one to keep an eye on, and we will be looking at another contractual issue that's actually been mopped up in La Liga in just a moment, as we discuss Lionel Messi's new deal at Barcelona, and then after that we'll be talking the Copa del Rey, which returns in the midweek. So Lionel Messi is definitely staying at Barcelona. There are no ifs, no buts. The release clause on the Argentine's contract has been bumped up upwards of 700 million euros. Not even Paris Saint-Germain are going to be paying that anytime soon. Not even Pep Guardiola has that sort of funds at hand at Manchester City. But there is a but, I'm afraid. Whenever these sort of deals come up, you think, why have certain things happened? And in this case, it's why did it take so long for Lionel Messi to have that photo and really sit down and answer the questions as to what's gone on in this whole deal? What did you make of the relationship between Messi and the board has been sort of public recently with the summer transfer sagas and everything that went on beyond that. What have you made of this whole, the fact that the contract situation is now summed up and dealt with?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so simple, but it's a pretty bad sign if someone doesn't want to take a photo with you, especially when it's, you know, Lionel Messi takes photos with countless fans every week.
I went up to Lionel Messi to take a photo.
Yeah, even took a photo with some random Argentine footballer he didn't even recognise a few weeks ago in Russia. Lionel Messi takes photos with literally anybody. I think we've seen that with every event he goes to. He's happy to take his photo. So the fact he wouldn't even be seen, you know, hovering over a piece of paper with the man who, you know, signs off on his wages was, you know, it sounds so simple, but I think it says a lot. And obviously, he was waiting to find the right moment to sort of sit down and I guess having just won the golden shoe, and well, he won it obviously last season, but having been presented with it, maybe this was the good time to sort of get that photo out there. But yeah, the fact it took so long, and the fact that, you know, Messi and Bartomeu, everybody was aware that everybody was asking why is it taking so long. So I just found it very, very curious. And There's surely an underlying meaning, an underlying reason why Messi didn't want to be seen posing with the current board, probably after the very short departure of Neymar. Maybe he didn't want to be seen to be associated with the people whose, I guess, incompetence allowed that to happen.
Yeah, well, it's also considering that Andres Iniesta's own contract, I mean, two most important players of the club by some distance,
sure,
seen Iniesta.
Sure.
He also took a while to sign his new one. I also thought that the quote sort of said anything, and considering that Bartomeu and everyone has said this contract had been signed for a while, and it's interesting the comments that came out. Valverde, for instance, he said, "We're all more relaxed now, but we're already seeing the commitment he has with the club." Being more relaxed, I mean, if he'd already signed it, it wouldn't really change anything. Bartomeu, for instance, said, "With this one, we've agreed on a new deal to adapt his buyout clause, which is more in line with the current transfer market situation. Perhaps addressing the rumours that someone like City or PSG were going to come in." And Messi himself saying, "We've been needing to do the signing for some time, and now it's done, and that he's happy to be at the club, which is his home." If he knew the signing had to be done for some time, you know, he would have done it. And with the things, you know, there's trouble at Barcelona in terms of the wage bill is getting out of hand a little bit. There's a lack of confidence in the board and the no confidence vote. Does this put Bartomeu and the board in a much stronger position to rectify the sort of niggling issues that have been going on around behind the scenes of the club?
I don't really know that it does. I mean, I think this was like a lose-lose situation for the board. I mean, if they'd failed to sign him, they'd have been driven out of the town by a mob with torches and pitchforks. But, you know, to sign him to a deal after delay still doesn't look that great. And it's this was the kind of thing where they could only... It could only have been worse. So I think they'll be relieved, but I don't think their standing is particularly improved, because this is probably a deal that most fans expected, and, you know, underline that word expected, to be done. So the fact that it was isn't a great achievement for Bartomeu. This could only have been a disaster if they hadn't got it done. I don't know if you agree with that, but I think this was it would have been a shock if they hadn't been able to sign Messi to this club. To a new contract with his club, given that, as he said, it is his home.
Yeah, well, it would have been a genuine shock. The thing is, as well, is that technically speaking, until he signed in January, he was free to negotiate a free transfer departure, which I think maybe, you know, we've been talking about this sort of situation for some time now, and that really was a deadline, if you like, because as soon as it becomes January 1st, no matter whether you say Messi's dad has signed a contract, but on January 1st, the offers are going to arrive and they are going to be in the newspapers, and the confidence in the Barcelona board continues to deteriorate at that point. So I think it is, it's hugely vital that it happened, but the scenario, the parallel universe somewhere where it hasn't happened, I think would really show just how precarious a position the Barcelona board were in. It's Real Murcia on the 29th of November, on Wednesday, at 7:30 Spanish time, CET, for Barcelona fans to look out for. And we will be talking the Copa del Rey in just a few seconds' time. Now, Ewan, when we're going into another round of Copa del Rey matches, I kind of want things to be kicking on and be getting interesting. I mean, it's only November, sure, but I'd like to have some, you know, real meaty games to get interested in and look forward to. But I just find that this Copa del Rey round of fixtures that are coming up this midweek, there's really very little to get excited about in my books.
Yeah, there's not that many interesting games. Even the Inter La Liga clashes are all a bit nothing too exciting. And the ones with the big teams as well. It's great for the for division clubs to be able to play some big teams. But for Barcelona, Real Madrid, and Atletico Madrid fans to get excited is it's going to take a lot. I mean, even Atletico Madrid, we've got tickets as cheap as €10 for the game against Elche at the Wanda on Wednesday night, and it still won't be anything close to being sold out. So I think that just tells you how little appetite there is for this fourth round of Copa del Rey.
Yeah, and as a neutral, the Elche game actually seems to be probably the most interesting with the 1-1 draw in the first leg. Villarreal lost to Ponferradina. Espanyol are currently being held by Tenerife, as are Athletic Club by Formentera. But still, I don't have the optimism like I have with certain other cup competitions of the same nature that there will be an upset. And fundamentally, I think that the provision of upsets and making upsets happen is what these cup competitions are for. And for me, I just get the sense that you know, you can disagree with this, but the two-legged system in these early rounds, for me, I just don't really see the point of it.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I mean, yeah, you mentioned there some of the teams that didn't win their first leg. There's five La Liga teams in the last round's games failed to beat the lower league opposition. Yeah, every single one of them is favourites with the bookmakers to ultimately prevail and to move on to the next round, which kind of says it all. I mean, you have two legs. It really is a safety blanket for the top division teams when it comes to avoiding upsets. You know, a third division side like an Elche, yeah, they might be able to hold Atletico Madrid to a draw, maybe even win one game, but to do it twice over two legs is just it's just so impossible for them. And it wasn't always like this, of course. I mean, the two-legged format came in at this stage, the stage when top-flight clubs enter in 2005-06, which isn't that long ago. And before then, you know, there was a couple of rounds where the top division teams would play a one-legged game, just as the rounds before this fourth round are one-legged. So in that scenario, there is a chance of an upset. Whereas in the last 10 years, we haven't really had many upsets at all. And I think it's telling that, you know, it tends to be the top four big sides in the country that are the ones in the finals and winning them.
Well, we had Alaves making a run to the final last year, and that was a real, you know, that was a real shock. We don't have that in Spain very often, where a team such as, you know, someone who had a really good season, Alaves, last year, made the final, and it was still a big shock. We've got to, you know, let's think about a way to improve the Copa del Rey, to spice it up a little bit then. I think one of the sort of derided factors, but certainly something to look into in Brazil, is that they have the regional championships, they have the state-sponsored competitions where, obviously, it's more local-orientated, and that takes up quite a large amount of the season, but with Spain and certainly with the lack of away sort of impetus, let's say, on the fans and the travel links and everything like that, does sort of regionalising this competition for the opening rounds make it a lot better in your mind? Would that add an element to competition, or would ultimately that just be a bit of a gimmick in your mind?
It could work. I mean, I think it would help with attendances because, you know, we have to remember all Copa del Rey matches are played in midweek, which is another thing that's is quite different from many other countries. I mean, looking at England and Scotland, for example, you know, FA and Scottish Cup games are played at the weekends. Fans can travel to it and you get a bit of atmosphere. For a fan to be able to travel, and some of the games kick off at 7:30, most people aren't out of work by then. So to be able to travel far, you'd really have to take a day off to be able to go to a Copa del Rey game. So yeah, to have a regional system would surely drive up attendances. You wouldn't have to travel quite as far, and there would be quite some interesting ones as well. I mean, the Basque Country, for example, you've got four first division teams. Even the Community of Madrid one would be quite interesting too. The problem is there's always going to be some regions, you know, Castile and León, La Mancha. There's, you know, there's some regions in Spain where there's maybe not quite as much of a hub of top class teams. And I guess, so in your idea, do the winners of each regional section then go on to face each other in a sort of Copa del Rey final round, or how would you pitch this one?
I don't know. I think you could probably separate it into four regions. You know, you could have the north, the sort of Basque / Galician section. You could have a Madrid section, which would include places like León and teams like Cultural Leonesa. Then you could have your Barcelona / Valencia core and then the Andalusian, because you are going to find in the Andalusian section in particular, there's a lot of, you know, top teams, whereas in the Barcelona section, maybe only two or three teams. But sending a winner of that into a semi-final draw, which then could be two-legged and what have you, I think it'd be interesting. I doubt it's going to happen, frankly. I can't see it happening. There are some other ways that competition to perhaps losing interest have been made interesting. One has been the EFL trophy in England, which is sort of the lower league and now has the academies of the top teams in it, where they have a requirement for players, you know, either it's got to be a certain amount of youth players or a certain amount of players who played the weekend before. Is forcing teams to play certain players a benefit to this competition?
Yeah, I mean, it could be for development. I mean, that's what they used to do, of course. They had, you know, youth teams used to be able to participate in the Copa del Rey, and, you know, Real Madrid Castilla even got to the final, and I think it was the start of the 80s, and they played the senior side. They got beat 6-1, fair enough, but after that, youth teams had to withdraw from the competition, and I think that just led to the senior sides playing those same youth teamers, but as if they were part of the A team. So I think having young players certainly isn't a problem. I get why in England and some of these trophies they want to get younger players playing in these things against senior players. And I think, you know, for all the faults of the Copa del Rey's current format, that's one of the things that does happen, because the two-legged format allows La Liga clubs to field youth teamers and to be able to probably still come away with a win. One of the interesting things, of course, is that final when Castilla got to the final was they got to participate in Europe, because back in the day, you didn't just have to win the competition to claim a Europa League berth or UEFA Cup berth. You did just have to reach the final. You didn't have to win it. Whereas now, Alaves, for example.
I would bring that back, definitely. I would bring that back. And like Alaves, in my mind, should have got to Europe in that last season.
Yeah, for sure. Rather than put the Copa del Rey's European place onto seventh in the league, if it happens to be won by a team which is already qualified for Europe, which happens almost every year. So, yeah, if you had this sort of attraction for medium-sized La Liga clubs, where you're told, okay, like if you can make it to the final, you might have to defeat one big club on the way there. But if you can make it to the final, you've got a good chance of getting into Europe. You don't have to necessarily win the whole thing. And I think that would be motivation for a lot of teams that know they're probably not going to qualify for Europe through the league. And, you know, a team like Alaves, if they'd been told you would get that European spot by getting to the final, they'd have tried even harder than they did. And I think that would make it very interesting. And then that would probably, you imagine, make the upper class teams in La Liga have to field stronger sides as well, if they know that they're going to come up against, for example, a Real Betis that's going all out to make the cup final.
I've run through the fixtures then. On the 28th, the stand-up fixtures, Real Madrid at home to Fuenlabrada at 9:30 Spanish time. That is 2-0 to Los Blancos going into that game. Barcelona, as I say, play on the early evening kickoff on Wednesday, as do Sevilla when they host Cartagena. Atletico Madrid host Elche at 9:30 on the Wednesday, with Bilbao in that aforementioned game against Formentera on the same time. And then on Thursday, we also have Alaves, Getafe, Villarreal trying to overturn their deficit against Pom, Ferradina and Valencia playing Zaragoza, before another very interesting weekend of La Liga action coming after that. I'll just give you a quick rundown of who's playing on the Friday night. It kicks off with Malaga versus Levante. Stand-up games on the second, the Saturday. Barcelona hosting Celta Vigo in the lunchtime kickoff, before Real Sociedad goes to Atletico Madrid. Saturday, really the key game, the key day to watch in terms of this week's La Liga, with Sevilla hosting Deportivo La Coruña and Athletic Club hosting Real Madrid on the Saturday, before the likes of Leganés versus Villarreal, Getafe versus Valencia, Eibar versus Espanyol and Las Palmas versus Real Betis on the Sunday, to round off and hopefully another very interesting and maybe controversial weekend of La Liga action. We can't rule that out. Well, thanks, Ewan. It's been a great half an hour or so chatting with you. If anyone wants to get involved on Ewan's Twitter, we'll be tagging that in the Marker in English page, of course. And you can find us at Marker in English on Twitter and on Facebook and on basically Google search is always the best one. And Ewan himself is at eMuktir on the Twitter.
That's the one.
Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's all good. And we will be back in a week or so to round off another exciting weekend of La Liga action. Goodbye.